Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You're listening to Why We Do What We Do.
Welcome to Why We Do What We Do. I am your scientifically alarmed host, Abraham.
Yes, and I'm your perpetually skeptic host, Shane.
We're a psychology podcast. We talk about all the psychology things, and we're talking right now. We're leading into the second part of a discussion that we've been having that follows on the heels of a previous discussion where we were unpacking facilitated communication. This episode is going to really dive into much more of the girth of this topic, if you will.
Yeah, I think this is where the real unpacking comes in, right? Like, so like, you know, when you move and you're just the first day or two, you're trying to find your pillows. This is where we're starting to really unpack the silverware and make sure it goes into the right drawer.
Sure. In the first episode, I do think that you'll want to listen to that if you haven't already, because it does go over a lot of the history and background of facilitated communication. But I think we can summarize it really quickly before we dive into today's discussion.
Yeah.
But first, I want to say that if you're joining us for the first time, welcome. Probably go back and listen to that first episode.
Yeah.
But the heaviness of the content is going to be in this discussion today for the most part. And on top of that, before we go into our quick summary, we should also acknowledge that this episode comes out on March 29th.
Ah.
And there are some holidays that occur on March 29th that we can talk about really quick, just to acknowledge that, you know, maybe you're celebrating these and we see you celebrating them. One of them is National Smoke and Mirrors Day.
Ooh, I like magic. It's also Manatee Appreciation Day. As a Floridian, I will say that I appreciate manatees so much. They are so gentle and such wonderful creatures.
I love manatees, and unfortunately, I never got to see one while I was living down there, but I appreciate them very much, so great day.
They are pretty scary if you're like in water and they show up, because you're like, they're huge. They are enormous animals, but so gentle.
I don't think that I want to like hang out with them in the water, but I would love to see them from the shore.
Sure.
If that makes sense.
That's fair. That's fair.
It is also National Lemon Chiffon Cake Day. So if you're into that, go celebrate.
I've never had one of those. That sounds nice.
I don't think I have either.
It's also Niagara Falls Runs Dry Day, which is thinking about kind of the phenomenon it would take to stop a waterfall of that magnitude is horrifying. So don't like that.
Yeah. Apparently a lot of ice.
So much ice.
It's also, I think, kind of related to manatees in a way, International Mermaid Day.
Actually, very related. Very related, because apparently manatees are mermaids.
Yeah.
It's also International Piano Day. So for those of you who enjoy the band Queen, go learn some piano songs from them.
Yeah, sure. Why not? Well, I love piano, so all of that works out great. Anyway, you might do some smoke and mirrors while with a manatee who is pretending to be a mermaid eating lemon chiffon cake and talking about the day that Niagara Falls runs dry and playing piano or something like that. So I hope you enjoy your celebration if you are taking on those things.
Yeah.
But as I said, we need to talk about facilitated communication. We have so much to unpack in this discussion. If you like the show and would like to support us, you can join us on Patreon, pick up some merch, leave a rating and review. You can also mow WWD, WWD into your lawn and then tell all your neighbors why you've did that strange thing. And yes, in celebration of our podcast.
Absolutely.
I'll talk more about how you can support us at the end of this discussion. As a quick summary, Shane, what do people need to know about the history, background, and overall procedure of facilitated communication?
Yes. So facilitated communication was started many, 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 many years ago in the 70s. And it is a form of intervention, we'll say, that is used to help people who have motor control issues be able to supposedly communicate with other people through the use of either a letter board or a keyboard, but there is a facilitator. The facilitator being the person that helps guide or stabilize the person's motor movements so they can type and share words. But there are some controversies about this, and we're going to kind of unpack all that. But that's kind of the gist of it right now. Started in the 70s, Syracuse got involved, and now there's facilitators.
Yes, that's great. That was a very good summary.
Hey, thanks.
One of the things that we kind of didn't do until the end of the last discussion was make sure we were really clear on the point that the idea behind facilitated communication is that the person who is holding the hand of the typer is not supposed to be the one who is authoring their writing. Like, they're supposed to just be helping them stabilize their muscles so that the person who's receiving this is the person whose message it is once they finished typing it all out. So that's
right.
That's supposed to be what's going on inside of this. And the hypothesis then was, as you said really well, that the people who are getting support could communicate. They just don't have enough control over their motor movements to do so effectively. And so they just need someone there to help them, to guide them. Right. That's the idea.
Right.
So we left off on a lot of statements that people had made that were sort of in support of this. They use very marketing, flashy, feel-good sort of terms. But what we didn't dig into yet, and what we're going to start with today, is getting into understanding how people interact with science around this. And there's sort of a public problem with science, generally speaking, and some very specific ones. And a way that this was highlighted was during... at the beginning of the COVID pandemic, we saw sort of science playing out in a sort of real-time way where we kind of were in a lot more contact with the sort of science that happens normally behind the scenes, but this time really in our faces. And I think the clearest example most people point to was the inconsistent recommendations about wearing masks. Do you have to wear them outside? Do you have to wear them at all? Should you double mask? When is it appropriate to mask? How often should you change your mask? Should you not wear your mask? Like, it changed a lot.
What is a mask?
What is a mask? Is it Halloween every day now?
Right.
It changed dramatically, rapidly, and it had a lot of people feeling really frustrated because they didn't know what to do.
And ultimately, this is not a flaw in science. It's actually kind of exactly what science is. The scientific method, the discovery of new information, updating our information based on new information. And this scientific method, that method specifically is for understanding a particular phenomenon and making discoveries. So we have this idea, we have this thought, we have this question, and we try to answer this question or series of questions through this method. And as we gain more information, our decisions, our understanding of the world and the universe around us are going to change. It doesn't just usually happen on nightly news, though. And that's kind of the thing with something like COVID, where every week we were getting new updates about this thing that we knew nothing about. We watched I don't want to say the most transparent, but we did watch a very transparent discussion about this phenomenon that was impacting so many people. And that in itself kind of led to this issue of science denial, where it's like, well, what is it? Is it this or is it that? Is it you tell us this last week, now it's all of a sudden this? It's very confusing. And that's kind of a very easy slippery slope you could see people leading into, like, the science denial space.
Usually we get the final product, like all the discussions that happened in the news and in policy that was affecting a lot of people. Usually that's worked out before it makes its way to the main public. This right. time it was like playing out with the public at the same time. But yeah, science denialism, I think, has been a problem for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
Arguably as far back as leading into what one might call the Dark Ages in European history, which was not the Dark Ages for the rest of the world, just that small small section of it. And right. obviously well before that, and certainly more recently in the last century, where we've seen some really explicit campaigns against any kind of understanding of science in the world. And I also want to be clear that we understand science and scientists specifically have done terrible things in the past.
Right.
Science is a tool, and humans make mistakes, a lot of them. And sometimes their motives are not very good, right?
Right.
Because it is a tool that can be used for good. And generally speaking, there are processes to try and ensure that it is used for good, but it can and has been used for harm. And many scientists, not all of them, but many of them have made it their mission to establish guidelines for ethics, ethical experimentation, to establish boards of objective third-party sort of removed people to constantly review and evaluate the relative contribution of a scientific experiment or investigation compared to its potential for benefit or harm, so that they can figure out, like, is it worth the risk to do this study? Because if it's not, then we don't approve it and you cannot move forward with it.
Right.
Nevertheless, that crappy, bad science slips through the cracks all the time. And I think that's a topic for another day, but it is important to understand that we are acknowledging, we are acknowledging it. And it's, I think, important to understand that science has done these things, but it is also built in mechanisms to try and correct for those things.
As much as humans can. Right?
Yeah.
You know, with the amount of questions that are being answered and stuff. And so that leads to this idea of scientific literacy and what that means and what that means for the public at large. And scientific literacy is fairly uncommon. I mean, many of us have taken classes on what the scientific method is. Many of us know what a hypothesis is. We've had those discussions. But what you find is in science discussions, people don't really know what those actually mean. People will say, I have a theory.
Right.
And it's like, no, you don't have a theory. You have a thought. Yeah. A theory is a very different thing than a thought.
Great. I love that.
And so, or like when people say, I've done my research. No, you have read a couple things. That is not doing the research. And I think it's really important to understand that those terms that get used, especially in pseudoscience circles, get thrown around very loosely. They're very loose interpretations of what research and the scientific method and what a hypothesis and a theory are.
Yeah, commonly.
And so it is really important to educate people on how to interpret, understand data, how to understand conclusions, how to understand reports, how to understand contextual variables that specifically when studies come out, what question they're actually trying to answer, and also what questions it yielded, new questions, new research lines, other questions that are needed to solve this larger problem. I mean, a single study is a single study. It's a unique contextual thing. Under very specific guidelines, right?
Yeah.
And so when people see a study, they'll go, oh, look at this study. This study says this. That's great. That's one study. That's not consensus. And so most people don't know how to kind of grab onto that and understand that and go further in their scientific inquiry.
Yeah, absolutely. And not only that, but understanding the quality of that study, because there are certainly some very poorly done studies where you look at and think, like, why did you exclude this group of people that would be really your primary group of people if you are interested in understanding this phenomenon better?
Right.
That seems critical to making sure you've got a good handle on this. Or why did you exclude this piece of data that would like completely refute your hypothesis here, even though it's completely relevant to the question you've asked and your design?
Right.
And on the one hand, I think that it is important for us to try and educate the public about this. And I think Alan Alda would tell us it's at least as important, if not more so, to educate scientists on how to better communicate with people.
Yes.
Although we're not necessarily going to be able to, or even try that hard, to have the pseudoscientists, the people who are doing shoddy, poor scientific work that looks like science, even though it really doesn't meet the standards of science, we're probably not going to try and help them communicate a lot better, but they're already really good at it. Matter of fact, oftentimes they came at it from marketing first. They started
right.
with PR and ended at, now I'm going to do these studies.
Right.
And so they already know how to get their message across. So we're kind of battling that for those of us who started with, I love data and spreadsheets and graphs. And like, I like learning these things and then not knowing how to talk to other people about it without sounding like an elitist nerd.
Right.
And so it is going to be very important for us, I think, to learn to be better at just generally communicating what we do as scientists so that people don't necessarily have to be scientists themselves just to understand what we're saying when we do a study.
Yeah. And I think a good place to start is not just to like dash people's dreams not entirely. Like, a lot of times what scientists will do is be like, nah, that's not what the science says. And that's not usually helpful for people who are holding on to something. It's important to have, like, very empathetic and compassionate discussions. Scientists don't typically do that. And as a matter of fact, I think when you read Bad Habits by Paul Offit, he shares a story about how he did that. And it was like, that did not work out. And he was made an enemy very quickly when he did that.
Sure.
So
yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, science communication is an entirely different skill.
Yeah, although I will say, having had scientists dash my dreams, I was usually very grateful afterward because I like being shown when I'm wrong about something so that I can be right about it moving forward.
Yeah, yeah, right.
But doing it kindly is certainly important. But speaking of dashing people's dreams, I'm going to have to ask you to listen to some ads for a moment.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
So, welcome back. We were just talking trash about scientists, but more so what we're doing was just understanding kind of the problem of science in the public eye. And so scientists and those with an empirical background tend to understand data, data analysis, how data are obtained, variables within experimental designs. They also often hold some level of scientific skepticism when new information is presented. So what you'll find is that scientists have this specialized training to understand how data comes in, out, how it's organized, how to interpret it, and how to ask the right questions around this stuff. And that's really important for understanding kind of scientists in the public eye and how they're presenting information. They're usually presenting information after they've interpreted some things and come to some conclusions.
And I do promise we're going to get more, we're going to talk about facilitated communication very soon. We just wanted to make sure we had this established background. Yeah. And so, yes, you're exactly right. You take that, the people who have training and experience and empirical experimentation and what that looks like, and then you contrast that with policymakers, parents, educators, and administrators. Of course, it depends. There are people in that group who are perfectly able to consume this. And consumers' backgrounds may not necessarily allow them or facilitate them understanding or being very interested in quantitative data as it's being presented by, you know, the scientists, those in the, you know, the white lab coats, the elitist sort of group. Instead, it's very easy to jump on sort of feel good stories, reports from other parents who feel like their child is heading in a positive direction, who have so much hope, and there's so much evidence, or what looks like evidence, it gives the veneer of evidence that they can latch onto and feel like, yes, finally things are going well for us. I want to ride this wave as long as I can.
Absolutely. So remember earlier when we were talking about how the outcomes of facilitated communication were startling and remarkable and how that was a red flag?
Last episode.
The last episode, right? So we spent a lot of time on that.
Yeah, yeah.
So naturally, people wanted to study this remarkable, startling phenomenon. And so most of the early research about this was, it was built on two very specific foundations. One, qualitative reports, yes, data, but not experimental, not to be able to like show replications and stuff. So we're going to talk about qualitative data in a little bit because qualitative data are important, but they hold a different importance in the kind of the discovery area of science.
Yeah.
So facilitated communication went this route. They wanted to look at qualitative reports and ethnographic methods. So observation in someone's cultural environment with the goal of developing a narrative account of that culture. So again, this is a narrative account. Qualitative data tends to kind of look at anecdotes. They look at experiences. They look at all of those things and they try to develop themes and kind of unique interpretations of whatever those experiences are.
Right.
Typically, qualitative data are not going to yield replicable experimental data to show that interventions work.
Yeah, well, exactly. Because just in case we weren't clear, I mean, many of our listeners will know what this means. But when we say qualitative data, we mean things like describing how something looks or feels. It's saying like, this showed improvement. That would be qualitative data. I feel like this was useful. That would be qualitative data. Like if you ask for a feedback report about a parent's experience with an intervention and they say, I'm glad I did this, they would then turn around and say, you know, 8 out of 10 people reported they were glad that they did this. And that is a sort of form of taking qualitative data as something. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't tell us, did it work? How much did it work? To what extent did it produce meaningful change? How did we measure that change and anything like that? And so the other way that people would study startling and remarkable phenomenon is with quantitative data, where they take actual specific measurements with outcomes in mind that they can then look at the numbers and say, yes, we either did or no, we did not meet our goals with this intervention that we were looking at. So let's start with the qualitative reports and what's happening here.
So let's put some fuzzy definitions on these things so we can appear sciencey, but also avoid criticism because we like definitions. Now, qualitative data are encouraged and should include a couple different things. They should include style, speed, and accuracy of the student's fine motor control movement to the letters or keys. That's fairly consistent across facilitators. So we should see that type of report across multiple facilitators who are saying, yes, this person is accurately reporting, they're quickly typing, you know, while I'm facilitating. Those types of things would be some kind of qualitative data within that.
Sure. Another piece of this would be that individuals are making typing errors that are unique to them. So you have a facilitator working with an individual and that individual makes certain typos or typing errors. And you say like that definitely is their voice because they make those typing errors and other people are not making those typing errors. And some individuals fairly consistently hit more than one key at a time when they're trying to type. And again, you might chalk that up to also some of the issue of the motor control that they have. And some of them are going to be better or worse at certain parts of the keyboard or typing and that sort of thing.
Right. Now, another part of this is many individuals might produce phonetic or invented spellings that are unique to them, but do not appear in the writings of others, despite the fact that several individuals sometimes share a common facilitator. So that would be some unique kind of interesting data to have is reporting on that individual makes this common phonetic spelling or this spelling error, even though they have the same facilitator with somebody else. It only happens with this person, and that's kind of a unique experience.
Yeah, and again, we are still talking about qualitative data, meaning that we get these reports that this is a thing that happened. Another one is that an individual is typing phrases or sentences that maybe sound a little unusual or unconventional, and you would not really expect to come from the facilitator because they seem like they're unique to that person, talking in a way that is really their way of speaking. They've never spoken before, but it seems like it's their way because it doesn't seem like it's coming from someone else who is there holding their hand.
Absolutely. Some other points too, individuals will sometimes produce content that is not known to the facilitator. That's a thing that could be used. And also through facilitated communication, individuals reveal their personalities, which from a qualitative standpoint, if people were able to report, that's one thing, but we did a whole episode on personalities and what they are and if they even exist and all that. So it's important to kind of understand that that might not work quite as well.
Now, all of this seems pretty good. You're like, well, that seems like you have everything you need. Like if they're doing things that are unique to them, if they're reporting things that the facilitator shouldn't know, if they're making errors because or spellings that are unique to them because they don't otherwise have a lot of contact with it, that should be enough to say that at least there's probably something here, right? Well, we'll get into that. One of the things is that, as we said, in the qualitative reports, you can have qualitative and quantitative at the same time. But in these situations, there were no standardized measures from the facilitated communication community to determine the effects of baseline. So where were you starting at to where did you get to?
Right.
Right. It's pretty, I mean, that's not really hard to do. You simply say, like, how many words were you producing? How many things were you responding to? How many things could you name? How many things could you ask for? You can count that pretty straightforward.
Right.
You can even, you know, just say, like, what do you need right now? And get an idea of, like, how often someone's doing something versus when they have someone who's present. And then just show, like, what's your effect? And I mean, even that bare minimum would probably actually look pretty good for some of these questions here. But they weren't using quantitative data.
Right. And so that's a really important aspect of this, is when qualitative data are used to come up with a conclusion, it's really dangerous to assume that that by itself is enough. Just to give an example, like when I did my dissertation was a qualitative study. And I was exploring and kind of trying to identify whether or not behavior analysts received self-care training in their graduate programs. So all of the people that I interviewed said, no, I did not receive that. However, that's just their own experience. That's not the overall, an actual picture of what might be going on. That study would have led to other questions like, well, let's evaluate programs and see how many include self-care training protocols in there.
Yeah.
That would be my quantitative part of that, where I'm pulling actual data, actual numbers from these lived experiences of people. And so what we find here in facilitated communication is that the studies with qualitative data were at odds with the studies with quantitative data. Their results conflicted, where qualitative data, those personal reports, those personal beliefs, those personal attitudes showed that it worked. There have not been any studies with quantitative data that have shown those objective measurements, outcome analysis, all of those things. They showed it did not. So we've got two different types of data that are showing different results. Qualitative saying, yes, it works. Quantitative saying, absolutely not, it does not.
Right. So you had people doing both. You had people who were doing the research that were using quantitative methods, and you had the research who were doing the quote unquote research who were doing qualitative methods. And when something seems too good to be true, like, for example, you take someone who has never meaningfully engaged in any kind of communication whatsoever before, or it's been severely, severely limited, to all of a sudden speaking as if they had were at the point where they should have college degrees because they were so eloquent and so articulate and so sometimes poetic in their speech, that maybe feels a little too good to be true. When something seems too good to be true, it often is. And so simply put, we needed to know if facilitated communication was working. And we also, I think, wanted to know how it was working, if it was working. I mean, if for no other reason, then if this was a phenomenon that was really helping these people, awesome, 100% on board, we really want to do this. So we want to figure out how to teach and optimize it to help more people. Like, maybe there's something we could do that will get this out to more people faster, to spread it more, to like get more people communicating if it's going to be that effective. But that's not what we found. When the researchers were out there doing their thing, they could not get that. And otherwise, this would have become a like the leading dominant intervention for everybody who ever had trouble communicating. I think this would have taken over the world. But when we started like actually doing that quantitative research, it never panned out, not even a little bit. The moment the tiniest amount of scientific scrutiny was applied to this process, it crumbled faster than a house of cards in a hurricane.
Uh-huh.
Like a Florida hurricane.
Mm-hmm.
It fell apart immediately.
And this is not like an opinion. These are actual studies that have been done that have shown, hey, there's no effect here.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really important thing. Like, this is not us just coming in and being like, well, it doesn't work. It really is coming down to, we have not been able to produce the results that people are claiming.
Yeah.
And that is also a hallmark of pseudoscience, but we'll get into some of this stuff later too. Now, language itself, speaking of language and communication in general, it's not so simple. And it's specifically not as simple as motor control over our vocal or other muscular systems. Otherwise, every single organism on the planet, or the majority of them, because they can control their movement, they would be able to demonstrate some level of language similar to ours. And we could talk to our pets, which would be wonderful, but also kind of terrifying because I imagine that my pets are a little bit judgmental. I don't know what a cat, I don't want to know what a cat thinks. But But right. You can decide. I mean, you can decide whether that's good or bad. But language in itself is very complex and extremely cognitively demanding. Activities are related to languaging. Languaging itself requires a lot of different parts of the brain coming together to put some language and communication together.
And a ton of learning and a ton of practice.
It is not. Yeah, it's not an innate thing. It's a lot of things together. Delays in effective communication is one of the most common hallmarks of any intellectual delay or disability because it is one of the most difficult to learn and even so to master. So many of us do not have a grasp on our own language. We struggle with it sometimes. We're still correcting. I mean, you hear us kind of saying ums and uhs and likes and so-ons and all the things that we say as like filler words too. And we are still learning language ourselves, and it's incredibly complex.
Yeah, I've heard people who speak English say that they barely speak English, you know, because they feel yeah. like language is hard.
It really is.
We get really good at it for what it is, and we also know that we probably could be better in many ways. Uh-huh. Anyway, that's an important piece to this is understanding. So we made a kind of hard transition right there. We were talking about the quantitative studies, and we're going to get into those studies, but we wanted to start to talk about how language works when we're understanding what we wanted to evaluate and quantify and looking at, and also conceptually speaking, like before we've even have to dive into looking at the data, which we're going to talk about here in a second, but conceptually speaking, understanding that language, I don't know if I quantify this, 90%, like I'm making that number up, but a enormous part, if not the entire foundational premise of facilitated communication, is that motor control is the barrier to communication for these individuals. And I think that premise by itself is extremely flawed. I think that not only is motor control not the barrier to language, because language is so complex and requires so many other processes, I actually think that motor control may not even be a barrier to communication.
Right.
Like for a lot of people, like it might make it harder. It might make it a little bit tougher, but I think like many people have demonstrated a way around this. Like look at Stephen Hawking. He was sitting in a chair, unable to move anything other than like blink his eyes and move his mouth around a little bit. And he was able to then independently type to communicate. So he could barely move his body, and yet he was able to communicate. So I don't think that motor control is a very good premise for stating why you would need this process of facilitated communication. And so maybe I blew your mind. Maybe you're just like, yeah, duh. Either way, we have to listen to some ads again, and we'll be right back. Okay, so we've been digging into now understanding the difference and the importance of qualitative and quantitative data and how language works. And I think now is where we start to really get into understanding the importance of effective intervention on language. Because as we said, many, if not most of these people demonstrated very, very little language at all. They were not responding to language when spoken to or text. They were not producing it. They were not finding it. They were not engaging in it. It was not part of their skill set that was driving very much of their behavior. So obviously we want to try and communicate with these people as much as we possibly can. We see the potential there. And so when effective evidence-based therapy is applied to someone, it helps them develop language. We see all kinds of things change for them because language is such a radically different way of interacting with the world. We see changes in their behaviors overall. We see changes in their attitudes, their engagement. We see very commonly and almost as a hallmark of this, changes to their memory, how much they can remember and how far back. We see a change in the complexity of their communication. It is a beautiful thing when you have a team of people who are using evidence-based procedures to help teach someone and help them develop language. It takes a lot of work, though. We're talking about a comprehensive team of competent professionals. You don't go from never participating in language to suddenly having an explosively complex, highly developed communication system overnight. That just doesn't happen. Doesn't happen with any skill set,
right?
Let alone one as complicated as language. And yet that is what's being claimed in facilitated communication.
So you might be going, well, how do we evaluate this? Because it sounds like if people are reporting these good experiences, but the replications are not there, then how are we getting, like, why are we still coming to this conclusion from the people that are using it? And so there have been some experiments that have examined this exact thing.
So this is finally getting into the quantitative part.
This is the quantitative part, yeah. So let's simply give an individual a message and then give a facilitator a message, and let's see if they provide the same message. Super easy, super simple to run that test, right? We're good so far. We're on the right path. Now, what if we give the individual a message and the facilitator a different message, but tell them it was the same one that the individual received? So they both get different messages. The facilitator gets one, the learner gets the other, but we tell them that they got the same one. If the individual is communicating, then it doesn't matter at all what we said to the facilitator. That shouldn't be a problem. But if the individual should be able to recreate that message as they did before, with facilitator helping control motor movement, not deliver the message, right?
Yep, that's it.
Supposedly.
Yeah.
And this isn't even a hard test. Like, we haven't even gotten there yet. But not only do you not get the message given to the person, the communicator, you only ever get the message from the facilitator. And they've shown this in several studies where the facilitator is the one that's producing the message and not the learner who's typing.
Yeah, they tried different arrangements of this. So as you just described, one might be that you tell something to one person and tell a different thing to the facilitator. And the number of times that the individual typed the message that they received, zero.
Mm-hmm.
Flat zero, right? Another one was that they basically put a little barrier between the facilitator and the individual, and they showed them pictures at the same time. So the facilitator gets a picture, the individual gets a different picture, and then they just say, type what you saw. The number of times that the facilitator typed what they saw, every single time.
Mm-hmm.
The number of times that the individual typed what they saw, zero. I mean, this is very, very straightforward stuff. Like,
the thing is like, it's not like it's like there's nuance here. Like, it is,
yeah,
black and white. Like, it's a certainty.
Yes. So to be clear, the facilitator was dictating 100% of the messages for the autistic or whatever the individual that they were working with. The person that they were facilitating had no agency whatsoever in this process. None.
Right.
Zero. And just let that sink in. And people were crushed. Upon learning what they had done, many facilitators completely left their position. They did not even realize that they were the ones controlling their clients' messages. All of their messages, not even some of them. They were completely in control of every single thing that they typed and every message that they sent or wrote. And they were shocked and floored and saddened.
And I think it's important to note that when we talk about this, this is not like somebody's personal experience that this happened with. These are studies that have shown quantitatively, objectively, with these actual tests, that this was not something that was working the way that they had originally stated. These were not the findings that they thought they had.
Let's go ahead and plug in that audio section from the interview that we heard right here.
What happened when you learned of the results of the study?
I was devastated. It was, I think I wished the floor would open up. When I looked at the piece of paper, it just, and there was nothing there to validate that communication. I had to believe it because it was there in black and white, but I couldn't match it with the year of typing we had done with these individuals. It was just very upsetting.
To be perfectly honest, I cried. It just all broke forth that we were doing this, we were getting a lot of results, and now here in black and white is something saying it just doesn't exist.
That this relationship between you and the patient was in fact between you and yourself.
And I think what bothered me also more than that even was thinking of the parents of the individuals we work with, and that we had given them false hopes and then had to tell them that it wasn't real.
So, you know, we just played this clip of someone talking about their experience. And I think that's something we haven't really hammered home yet, is the importance of this. That's really critical to understand is the facilitators, almost all of them, really genuinely believed that they were helping these people author their messages.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk about this in a little bit, but the process behind this is called the ideomotor effect, is one that we now understand much better, partially in thanks to this. was part of it. There are other things going on. There's actually the Clever Hans effect, which we've done an episode about, that is going to be relevant in understanding this as this shifted and changed. But suffice it to say for now that they really felt like they were just helping the person find the letters that they needed to help them communicate, and that they were not controlling those messages. And the phenomenon is very, very robust. I mean, you could actually do this with somebody else and feel like you're not the person who is authoring that message, even though you are. It's one of those where it's sort of like in science class, they'll like show you how to do an experiment of something that's like really easy. You can do sort of on your own. I'm struggling to think of a really good example, but I remember in high school, they'll sort of show like, oh, did you know if you do this thing that like this will happen? And it's kind of mind blowing. And you're like, how could that possibly be how things actually work in the real world?
Right.
One that occurs to me that actually is like, maybe it's kind of silly, but it was like, if you heat water that goes through a narrow tube, it will actually, the water will flow upward through the tube. And like, that's how they get some of these basic beakers and stuff to work, is like the water will flow from one to another, but it has to flow up for a while. And that's because of the heat transfer.
Right.
And that's something that looks wild to see. You don't really understand or expect it to do that. And this was a similar thing here, is like, and I really like how she said that the experience that they have feels really real and legitimate. And so it feels like it doesn't match when you observe, when you see the data, when you've been observing what you've been observing for so long.
Yeah, I imagine that's quite confusing when you have that experience, like in the cognitive dissonance that goes along with that, right? Like, it's incredible to have to, I guess, like, because we're looking at it retroactively, like, right? Like, we're looking at it from like a larger scope, and we're going, okay, these people are saying anecdotally they're having this feeling. And then when you watch this study and you watch it play out, the results don't match at all. And how does somebody have that experience? And at being, I couldn't imagine being a facilitator and the struggle that would come along with feeling like you wasted time with that person, that you got them to consent to things that they didn't want to consent to, that they would never actually had a voice in all of this, when there was probably a more effective way to give them a voice, and we missed the opportunity for a year, 2 years, 5 years, however long they were receiving facilitated communication at this point.
Yeah. And I'm gonna play this just a little bit more of what she talks about, because we sort of outlined some initial experiments, which honestly they didn't really need to go much further than that. They already had pretty much doomed this to where it was gonna go. But this lady, actually, another implication of this might be, what happens if you deliberately try to not control what the person types? And so she goes on to explain some sort of informal experimentation she did to look at that.
I went back to every individual in our program that I had used FC with and tried facilitating with them with the same equipment they had used before, whether it was a keyboard, a letter board, or what, without me looking at the keyboard. All I got were strings of letters. And I didn't try it just once. I went back over several days.
You made your own study?
Yes. Very informal, yes. But, and I could not get a single individual to type anything.
So that is sort of another implication. It was like, well, let's see what happens if we stop, if we were like really careful to not control what they're typing, and then they stop typing things, you know?
Right.
Again, they could have done that study, and I think it would have been another interesting one, but they'd already basically shown, you know, and that was further, I guess it's not peer reviewed evidence, but it is a way of it trying to test and evaluate what they're expecting to have happen.
I think this is one of those moments where you've got an anecdote, right? You've got this person who was a facilitator who was engaged with this. And so we kind of already, I guess, maybe not necessarily debunked, but we kind of criticized why anecdotes are not consensus. Well, the thing is, in her situation, her anecdote more closely matches the quantitative results. So like, her anecdote of saying like, this didn't actually work, is matching the experience or the actual studies that were done to kind of show that this thing worked or didn't work, right? Like, there's a difference between early FC studies that are going, yeah, this is remarkable, this is fantastic, this is an amazing thing, and having that piece where that information is telling you that it works, and then getting a quantitative study that says it didn't. This woman is saying anecdotally, I am seeing now that it is not working.
Right.
And here's additional stories that support that it is not working.
Great point, actually. Yeah, that's a really good way of sort of bringing it back around to that as an aspect of it. Wow, man, our time goes by so fast, and yet the ads, they call again. Okay. For the remainder of this discussion, I want to make sure that we start getting really into some of the important understanding here of what's going on. And as we've been describing this, the studies that came out, they're pretty simple. It's just like, if you're the one writing this, then anything that I tell you, show you, or give you, you can then write about. And if I give something different to the facilitator, then they're going to write about that instead. And that's what happened.
Sure.
And I mean, it wasn't just that it happened some of the time. It was every single time. And the number, in science, it's pretty rare that you get a 100% skew in one direction.
I was going to say.
Right. That just doesn't happen.
Scientists don't usually get a slam dunk like that.
Yeah. So the fact that it was 100% in that direction was obviously very alarming. Okay. And so at this point, the writing is on the wall and things are only going to get worse for facilitated communication.
Right. So at this point in time, we already know it doesn't work. But where there is money to be made and there's power to be seized, there are people that are going to come in and they are going to take that opportunity to do that. And so where there's blood, there are sharks. And the predators were not about to relinquish control of their power and their income. And you started seeing an influx of people who wanted to make money, who were able to leverage the emotional appeal that they had for families who were vulnerable. And you started to see kind of a growth in the facilitated communication industry, unfortunately.
I pulled in a quote here I'd like to use that I think is where they start to go. So as you said, they immediately start getting defensive and trying to say, no, we need to be around. People should support us. We're doing the right thing. And they're basically then turn this and say, we have the moral high ground here, right? We are actually trying to help these people and you're trying to take that away. And I'm going to go ahead and quote a blog post from Stephen Novella in 2022. He says, quote, "This is perhaps the most pernicious method of pseudoscience promotion because it attacks and stigmatizes professionals just trying to defend good science. With facilitated communication, the narrative that has emerged is that those critical of FC are denying that any person who is non-speaking can have hidden cognitive abilities and that they are denying these people a voice and contributing to their marginalization in society and that such a position is part of a broader ableist bias. Nothing could be further from the truth." End quote. I think he said it exactly right there, that the people who are the facilitators, the people who are pushing facilitated communication, who once they know the data are sticking to their guns anyway, they are now knowingly preventing this person from getting support to help them actually communicate effectively. They are taking over that person's personality and their voice, and they're the ones then claiming that everyone else is against them and are marginalizing this group of people. Like, they're actively suppressing this person's ability to be independent and claiming that other people are doing that.
Yeah, because I'd like to return to that idea of independence, like independent communication. And under no circumstances does somebody who is receiving facilitated communication ever gain independent communication. There are no circumstances where that leads to that. What ends up happening is somebody maybe gains some skills through some other means. They are able to start typing using some kind of augmentative communication device, but facilitated communication and augmentative communication, like the alternative communication devices, AAC devices, are different things. Facilitated communication, yes, is a suggested intervention that shows that it does not work. Using a keyboard is a tool that allows somebody who can type to communicate and whatever device is there. And so what ends up happening here, I just want to be clear about this too, because I want to share the parallels. You're going to see the same kind of behavior in other pseudoscientific circles. Like this type of behavior of taking the moral high ground and attacking people who have certain opinions about this. So what ends up happening is proponents of facilitated communication have targeted psychologists, researchers, other practitioners for holding disabled individuals to unreasonable expectations for demonstrating communication. So what they're doing is they start to begin to vilify other professions in that same space, and they lay the groundwork that the facilitated communication practitioners, the FC practitioners, will meet the students where they're at and will support along the way, unlike those cold, rigid psychologists. And that becomes a problem. They're basically attacking entire professions that are just being a little bit skeptical about an intervention that you're claiming is extraordinary and remarkable.
Exactly right. Yeah. And again, I think I'm just going to keep hitting this point over and over again, because it's such a critical thing to understand, is in facilitated communication, the facilitator is doing the messaging, all of it, 100%, every time, unambiguously, that is the case. That means that the person who they're facilitating for is not communicating, is not doing any messaging, it is not engaging in any meaningful way with any aspect of that language. And I think what you said, another point that's very critically important, is that it would be one thing if we saw that, like, it was always the facilitator, but eventually that the person they were facilitating gained independence and, like, went out into the world and was then like, okay, well, yeah, they were doing all the communicating for me at first, but then I got there by myself. And as you said, that didn't happen, and partially because they weren't learning any skills. They weren't engaging in conversation. How could it happen? Right?
Right.
And there were a couple of cases where they specifically said, well, yeah, they did move from using facilitated communication to not. And I dug in on a few of those, and every place that I looked, in instances where someone went into facilitated communication and came out communicating independently, they were either already communicating independently before they went in, or they were receiving other supplemental evidence-based intervention in conjunction with their facilitated communication.
Right.
It was never, ever the case that, like, it was someone who actively needed support and facilitated communication was used as the intervention, and then the person came out the other end communicating independently. That never happened.
Right.
If and when it seemed to work, there was something else going on all the time.
Right. Right.
Okay. Oof. And so actually there's a quote here that someone made who was evaluating the research on this. And they said, quote, "There is no evidence in this volume that an ethnographer, psychologist, educator, or sociologist would recognize as the product of systematic research. Nothing here resembles research." End quote. And that was from Thompson, 1994. I forget the journal article, but that was published in a journal. I mean, they were evaluating the quality of the studies, if you will, that had been done in favor of and supporting facilitated communication. And I mean, you could even potentially claim that qualitative research constituted research, and this author could not make that conclusion.
Right. So I think it's important here to take a step back, because I think it's very easy to get very worked up about this, right? Like, it feels very charged.
And I know
it is. I am too. And I think it's important to remember that, like, when we're talking about this, this is coming from the scientific literature. This is coming from the place where this has been tested, evaluated, critiqued. This is coming through a scientific skepticism lens, which you can apply this lens to any pseudoscientific practice. And this is the same kind of pattern of behavior that you will see when you talk to flat earthers, when you talk to anti-vax folks. There's going to be some discussion in there about that random person that maybe benefited some way, somehow. There's going to be those anecdotal stories. But time and time again, when you apply the scientific rigor and the skepticism that we're talking about here to these types of interventions, specifically when it comes to facilitated communication, what you find time and time again is that it fails to meet the standards of scientific rigor. And that is incredibly important when we talk about this. It fails time and time again to meet that science-based evidence practice. Like, it's just not getting there. And that's what we're talking about here more than anything else. If you want our complete thesis, that's what it is. It just has not met that rigor yet.
And of course, and we're not forgetting the fact that we're talking about real human lives, right, that are affected by this. And so, as I said, it would be one thing if, like, we didn't have really good evidence, but we saw that these people were doing much better as an outcome of this, then we would definitely find a way to understand how, like, to get on board with this, make it make sense, fill in the gaps where we needed to with science, because we had the outcomes there, right? So there is some evidence. We didn't have evidence here. Science was not being applied, and when it was being applied, it had failed, and there were people who were suffering as an outcome of this. And I think a lot of people have heard this, and if you weren't already familiar with the story, you might be thinking to yourself, it doesn't sound like they were suffering. It sounds like they just weren't learning. And I think that, unfortunately, we've got to wrap up this conversation here, because we have so much more to talk about, and I think the next discussion should be getting into how they were suffering and the impacts that were made of this. And so when we were preparing for this, I kind of thought it might make its way to three episodes, and I wasn't sure. Maybe we could fit it all into a second discussion, but looking at how much more we have left to cover, I think we really should break this up into a third part, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, I think that's fine. I think the one thing I would say here is that if you are having the thought of, like, folks that are in facilitated communication aren't suffering, like, at this point in time, if you're not having that thought, you're like, it doesn't sound that bad. I think at its core, at its base, just understanding where we're at right now with the information that we have, where they are suffering and where there is a problem, is that they're losing time. Losing valuable time to be able to communicate, to be able to have an intervention that works. And it's the equivalent of, like, if you're sick and you're ill and there is a viable treatment, an effective treatment, and you're choosing to do something else that's not going to treat your illness, you're going to stay sicker longer. And this is something that kind of happens here, right? Somebody who has a limited verbal repertoire, like limited verbal communication, is spending more and more time in an intervention that does not work, which means that's less and less time that they could be getting some kind of intervention that would actually work for them. That's the basis of where the suffering and taking advantage of people who are vulnerable is actually happening here.
And to be clear, we're not comparing the experience of having, you know, being autistic or having some other intellectual or language delay means that you are ill in the sense of, like, having
right.
a disease.
Right.
But I think your point is a really important one. And you're absolutely right that what it is you're in a situation where we know that we can help this person and we're wasting their life and their time.
We're prolonging it.
Yeah, not helping this person. And so I think the comparison actually makes a lot of sense. I just want to make sure that people are clear. We're not saying that those are equivalent in that way.
Yes.
Just that the similarity overlies in the sense that there is, we only have this one life, right? And every day that we spend not doing something that we could be doing to help ourselves or help somebody else is time that we'll never get back. And it gets harder and harder to close those gaps the more time goes on. So, like, you're talking, if someone hasn't started speaking by the time that they turn one, that's not as big of a deal. If they haven't started speaking by the time that they turn two, you might be a little bit concerned. And if you are then using interventions that mean that you're not going to help them start speaking before they've turned three or four or five, it's going to be a lot harder to continue to start to close that gap as that time goes on.
Right.
And many parents have had this experience. I've spoken to them. You know, there was a lot of worry about the time lost there. And I think professionals feel the same way. Like, we don't want to lose that time. So
absolutely.
Anyway, and that's, like, possibly the tamest thing that happened as an outcome of facilitated communication.
Yeah.
So I'll tee it up like that. And you can join us next time where we're really going to get into and talk about why it's so critically, why this goes so far beyond just it didn't work and it wastes time, which are bad enough as it is. I think we'll get into some stuff that, if you want to hear me trying really hard to not cry, next episode is where you'll find that.
Yep. Absolutely.
All right. So before I'm crying, let's wrap this up here. Join us next time, and we'll cap this off with a few recommendations.
Recommendations.
Recommendations. Okay, I'm going to recommend an activity, which is to join a book club. I've only done a couple of these myself, but I always really enjoyed it. And we've even talked about potentially hosting one on the podcast. So Spotify has created this thing where you can now do polls. You can, like, do a Q&A or poll your audience. So I might even do this as a poll of, like, would you like to join Why We Do What We Do in a little book club where we read a book? I'll put that out there. Message us. You can do this on Spotify if you listen to us there. Otherwise, message us on social media or email us directly, anything you want to do. But my recommendation is join a book club and let us know if we should start a book club.
Yeah, I really like that. Totally down for book clubs. I read all the time. So yeah, I vote yes. Is what I'm saying.
It's basically just another day for Shane.
I love it, though. It's great. All right. So my recommendation is a comic book. It's a comic book series called Transmetropolitan. Did you ever read that or have you ever heard of it?
I have never heard of this.
It is a real wild time. It is not for the faint of heart. So I'll just give everybody a heads up on that.
Okay.
So Transmetropolitan is a cyberpunk transhumanist comic book series is what it's described as, written by Warren Ellis. If you're not familiar with Warren Ellis, Warren Ellis is known for, like, doing some, like, really cool cyberpunk stuff and really working on these different properties. Like, he's worked on Iron Man. He's worked on like some DC stuff. He has a series called Planetary that's super cool. He's done a lot of really interesting stories, but Transmetropolitan is a super fascinating story about journalism. Actually, it's a comic book about journalism, which is really bizarre. So the main character, his name is Spider Jerusalem, which is an awesome name.
Yeah.
And he is kind of like a really aggressive Gonzo reporter.
Okay.
Gonzo journalist in the future. So like he comes from the he comes back into the city from the mountains and is like exposing the corrupt nature of like the politicians and the police force and all that. He's big on the truth, what the truth does for the people. And he goes about it in really horrible ways because he is just not a likable character at all. But you appreciate what he's doing because he does kind of dismantle systems. It's a wild time. It is very dated. It is aggressive. It is very like the 90s version of what a cyberpunk dystopia would look like.
Okay.
But it's funny and there's moments that are like really insightful and it's a great commentary on society. So I recommend everybody check it out.
That sounds kind of amazing. I've never really got super into comics except for like a few here and there. And I've definitely really liked graphic novels a lot, but I feel like the more I've heard you talk about them and the more I've seen of them, the more I feel like I would really enjoy getting into some of them. So I'm on board with that.
I feel like there's some that you would really dig. I feel like you would like this one. I feel like you'd like Chew because Chew is real weird.
Nice. Sure.
Yeah.
All right, good deal. Well, if you would like to tell us about comics that you like or a book club that you'd like to join or to tell us if you'd like to join our book club or if we should start one, you should definitely reach out to us. As I said, you can do that on social media. You can also email us directly, info@wwdpodcast.com. Join us on Patreon. You get access to all kinds of bonus behind-the-scenes content, including where my camera completely stopped working and my audio stopped working, and Shane sort of talked to a faraway version of me for a moment during this episode. Mm-hmm. And there's other behind-the-scenes content you get. We've been starting to post more of our sort of discussions and like and resources to our Patreon that we use as we're creating episodes. So that's there. You get early access to episodes, all sorts of things. In addition, if you don't want to join us on Patreon, you can certainly support us by picking up some merch. Please leave a rating and review. You know, just email us to tell us things. We like that too. But yeah, the people who have helped make us helped us do this show include, but are not limited to, we'd like to start with appreciating the Disseminating Behavior Analysis Special Interest Group for their financial support of our podcast, as well as our Patreon members, which include Amanda, Brad, The Daily BA, Joshua, Justin, Kelly, Kim, Layla, Megan, Mike M, Mike T, and Stephanie. And as a reminder, we are running a campaign where if we get to 15 Patreon supporters, we will do a little group hangout. And if we get to 20, then we will do a more interactive hangout, one where we'll maybe play a game together of some sort, like a trivia or a make fun of Abraham something or other. I also like to make sure I thank my team, Patrick, who did all of the groundwork for helping us put together this episode. I also like to thank Selena and Patrick. And of course, thank you for recording with me today, Shane.
Of course.
And always the million thanks that goes to our audio mixmaster extraordinaire, Justin, for all of his wonderful work with these episodes.
MC Justin, I like it.
Yeah, MC Justin. Is there anything I'm forgetting or anything you'd like to add before we wrap up?
No, I think that covers it. I think the next episode, just to prepare everybody, is going to be even heavier. So just a heads up on that.
Yeah. Getting into the emotional toll. Well, please come back next time so we can finish up our discussion here and go back and listen to some other episodes on various topics we have cited or just anything that sounds interesting if you haven't already done that. But otherwise, I think that's all I have. This is Abraham.
And this is Shane.
We're out.
See ya.
You've been listening to Why We Do What We Do. You can learn more about this and other episodes by going to www.wwdpodcast.com. Thanks for listening, and we hope you have an awesome day.